Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's lecture. I'm always impressed with an LSE audience for this kind of event, that as soon as somebody comes to the microphone, you're so polite you suddenly become very quiet. So thank you for your self-discipline. I'm delighted to welcome each of you, and also very pleased that the ambassador of Greece to the UK, Dimitris Kalimitsos-Siras, is able to join us this evening as well. Tonight's lecture, as you can imagine, is part of a series organized by the LSE's Hellenic Observatory. And over the years, we've been able to welcome many leading public figures from Greece. The links between the LSE and Greece, of course, are exceptionally strong. The school has taught generations of students from Greece, some of whom have gone on to very prominent positions in public life, in business, society in Greece. Thus, Greece is one of the largest and one of the most active LSE alumni associations to be found anywhere in the world, and we're very proud of that. And of course, we feel that the LSE's Hellenic Observatory has achieved much profile in terms of its research and also in terms of its public engagement. Tonight, we're delighted to welcome our speaker, Yorgos Hourarakis, who is Greece's alternate Minister of Finance and currently the Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. George knows the UK very well, having obtained his MSc and PhD from the UK. He taught economics at the University of Essex and more recently at the University of Manchester. His research interests include macroeconomics, economic history, labor macroeconomics, international macroeconomics, and the macroeconomics of monetary unions. Since Syriza came to power in Greece at the beginning of 2015, George Hourarakis has been at the center of the storm over Greece's bailouts and its relations with its international creditors. In the spring and summer of 2015, he was the chief technical negotiator for Greece's current bailouts program, its third. He was the interim finance minister and then alternate minister. He's a member of the Eurozone Working Group and a member of the board of directors of the European Stability Mechanism. Thus, in short, George has been on the inside of Greece's negotiations with the European Union and the IMF continuously since May 2015, if not before. To friends and foe alike, George Hourarakis's reputation has gained widespread respect for his work as minister and the expertise he has brought to his task. In the febrile, sometimes febrile world of Greek politics, he's often seen as a potential economics minister and a figure with a bright future. Today, of course, Greece is once again hitting the headlines over its bailout program. The International Monetary Fund is split, and the IMF disagrees with the Eurozone leaders. Is the Greek debt sustainable? Should Greece undertake further commitments before it is given more debt relief? Can the third bailout program continue without the IMF joining in? The markets are again nervous. Greece's bond yields have shot up again. Greece's funding, it is said, until July. But what can be agreed for the period beyond July? We look forward to George explaining the way forward as he sees it and the conditions he feels are necessary for a sustained recovery for the Greek economy. We will have plenty of time for discussion afterwards, but to begin with, can you please join me in giving a warm welcome to the alternate Minister of Finance, Yorgos Hourarakis.
So, so thank you so much for your kind words, and thank you for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be here. And also a pleasure to be back in the UK. Let me also give you my apologies for being late here. We start late. We run a quarter of an hour late. Now, I was told to do something with the screen here so that I can...
colleague will help you.
Oh, here it is. Okay. Wonderful. So this is me, and this is my capacity in the Ministry of Finance. What I'm planning to do today is to guide you through the key facts of the Greek crisis going back to 2010. Then try to offer an explanation of how did it all start. What are the key causes, if you like, both the proximate and the ultimate causes of the Greek crisis? Then I will try to describe my job. I will try to explain how it is to manage an economic crisis when policy space is extremely constrained, as it is in Greece today. And then I will move on to, if you like, the core of my talk. I will try to answer why has the recovery taken so long to arrive. In Greece, we are 7 years now in stagnation, recession first, stagnation then. What have we learned from past errors? And therefore, what it is that we changed in the context of the third bailout program? And I will finally conclude with some observations on the opportunities as well as challenges and downside risks going forward. So let me start by stating the obvious for many of you. I'm sure you all know that the current crisis, the current economic crisis, is one of the worst economic crises that advanced market economies witnessed in peacetime. And this figure, I think, makes this point clearly. The figure compares GDP, gross domestic product, in the United States, 1929-1936. So T on the horizontal axis is 1929 for the red line, with the Greek gross domestic product, again at constant prices, 2009-2016. Again, T for the blue line is 2009. T plus 7 is 2016. And, there are two striking features, if you like, standing out. One is that the Greek recession has been nearly as deep as the recession of the Great Depression in the United States. The total loss in output 4 years into the Depression is very much in the territory of 25-30% in both cases. But the second salient feature is that although the U.S. economy recovered 4 years into the recession, 1933, many of you may know that this is the year that the United States abandoned the gold standard and therefore changed the deflationary expectations of households and firms. Here we are. The Greek economy is still in serious trouble 7 years into the recession. If you like, the pattern of the Great Depression was had a U shape, whereas the pattern of the Greek Depression has an L shape. And there is a big question mark. Why is that? Why hasn't the Greek economy recovered 7 years into the Depression? And to make my point clearer, let me compare the Greek crisis, again, the red line in the graph here, against how many? Four other great depressions. From the, again, the interwar depression, of the U.S. economy all the way to the East Asian crisis of 1997. In all five cases, the way I define depression is a cumulative fall in output, constant prices of more than 15%. And again, the comparison is striking. There are some, actually all cases recovered within 4 years. In the case of Uruguay, I think it was 3 years into the depression. The case of Indonesia and Argentina, 2 years into the depression. The case of Argentina, luck played a significant role because prices of primary commodities, especially soya, picked up quickly. But again, put the Greek case in comparative perspective, 7 years into the recession, no sign of recovery as yet, especially after 2013, line is flat. The last bit is the forecast for 2017, actually, is T+8, where we expect positive growth of 2.7% in real terms. And let me now zoom in on the Greek cases and what we have here. A third figure is the Greek output gap, if you like, the difference between potential output, what the Greek economy could have produced, and actual output. First half of the 2000s, the output gap is positive. The economy was overheating. I will come to this later. Second half, after 2009, 2010, a significant output gap in 2013, 2014 in the territory of 10 to 15%. That's a major, major recession. Part of it is clearly demand-driven. Part of it is the result of the shock. Part of it is the result of what we call in economics a hysteresis effect, a slowdown of potential output. So let me now move to the second. I don't think I need to press more on the point that the Greek recession is clearly one of the worst in the history of capitalism, at least in the history of advanced market economies in peacetime. So the obvious question is, how did it all start? And to answer the question, we have to go back to the beginning of the 2000s, the introduction of the euro. Let me give you a flavor of what I will say. The proximate cause of the big Greek recession is what we call the twin deficits, a simultaneous primary fiscal deficit on one hand, and a current account deficit on the other. So, what happened really in the first half of that decade, and as a result of Greece joining the euro, both private and mainly public sector external borrowing increased significantly at very favorable terms. We will see them, we will look at them in a little while. What one would call the euphoria effect, the effect that the euphoria that came together with participation in the European Monetary Union. As a result of significant public borrowing, the budget deficit widened and the economy overheated. And because the economy overheated, competitiveness suffered significantly. The real exchange rate of Greece overvalued, and the current account deficit deteriorated. So again, a quick look at the borrowing costs of the Greek state between January 1999 and, say, January 2009, blue line is a 10-year government bond yield of the Greek debt, and the red line is the same yield for the German debt. And as you can see, the gap between the two narrowed significantly into the 2000s, all the way till the end of this first decade. There were years where markets priced the Greek debt as low as the German debt. Basically, for markets, borrowing to the Greek state and borrowing to the German state was one and the same thing. There was no risk at all. And there was no risk at all because Greece was now part of one single currency union. Let me make clear here that Greece was not the only country that benefited from this huge capital inflow in the first 10 years of the new currency, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, all peripheral European economies benefited significantly. The big difference between the two is that capital inflows were directed to the private sector, mainly households, and fed into a housing bubble in those countries, whereas here is what happened. In the case of Greece, purple line is the primary deficit of the Greek general government as a share of GDP. Ignore the second half of the graph, post-2009, and just focus on the first half. What you see is a significant deterioration of public finances starting at some point in 2001-2002. By 2009, the primary deficit was about 10% of GDP. Yeah. And the result of the overheating of the economy was a significant deterioration of competitiveness. Here we measure competitiveness as the real effective exchange rate of Greece based on unit labor costs. So what we do is to divide the Greek unit labor costs by a weighted average of the unit labor costs of all other trading partners within Europe. Again, look at the first half of the part all the way up to 2009. Base year is 1999. We set the base year equal to 100. By 2009, the real effective exchange rate in Greece had appreciated by 20%. Yeah? Significant loss of competitiveness, at least in terms of unit labor costs. And obviously, as a result, the current account deteriorated significantly. Again, what we have here is the time evolution, the time profile of the Greek current account, the green line, against the current accounts of other euro area member states. And again, as a result of the overvaluation of the real exchange rate, the current account deteriorated significantly. By 2009, was 15%. The deficit was 15% of GDP. So this is exactly what I mean by the when I'm referring to the problem of that of twin deficits: a significant primary fiscal deficit on one hand, and the flip side, a significant current account deficit here. So fine, we just identified the proximate causes, what economists usually refer to when they refer to the causes of the Greek crisis. By 2009, the world economy was in serious trouble. Financial crisis, September 2008, Lehman Brothers, and so on. So liquidity across the world dried up, and that triggered a typical sudden stop of capital inflows into Greece. Why is that? Because markets increased significantly. The probability that the Greek state will not be able to service the cumulative deficits of that decade. Okay, so proximate causes are clear. Trigger is clear. Always, in a typical sudden stop episode, the trigger can be exogenous, sometimes trivial. In this case, it was not trivial, but it was clearly exogenous to the Greek economy. The ultimate cause, the lack of confidence of markets towards the Greek economy, was the fact that Greece had a legacy of weak fiscal institutions. And by this, I mean a low ability to impose discipline on expenditure, low compliance rates, especially tax evasion, low collection rates, because public administration was not up to the task at that point. And all in all, what we call in economics a deficit bias, that is a tendency to generate primary deficits in bad times, as one should, to stabilize the economy using fiscal policy as a stabilization policy tool, but not tidy up your public finances in good times, that is, not producing primary surpluses in good times, so that over the cycle your government books remain on balance. An entrenched, problem of deficit bias for many, many decades, going back to the 19th century. But a clear manifestation of the problem was in the first 10 years of the 2000s. Actually, if you go back to the 19th century, you will find out that a similar set of stylized facts characterized all previous debt default episodes. I'm referring to the default of 1843, the default of 1893, and then the default of the interwar years, 1932. Massive overborrowing and credit boom in foreign currency, external dependence, if you like, at very favorable rates, especially during periods when Greece adhered to fixed exchange rate systems, the classical gold standard in the 19th century, the interwar gold standard in 1932. Exogenous triggers led to sudden stops to capital inflows and currency crisis, and then following from currency crisis, currency devaluation, and coupled with currency mismatch, the fact that tax collection was in domestic currency, but external obligations in foreign currency, led to an increased probability of default, in three occasions actual default, and prolonged recession. The work of Carmen Reichardt and Trebesh, 2015, if I'm right, published in the Brookings Papers of Economic Activity, and Calvo and Reinhardt document well this pattern. It's a recurrent pattern in the Greek history. So let me now turn to how challenging it is to manage a crisis, a major crisis, when policy space is extremely constrained, as it is now in Greece. Let me start by outlining two key counterfactuals. Let's think about the counterfactual of a closed economy facing a typical demand shock, an adverse demand shock. A closed economy with a negative output gap can easily cope with a gap by using fiscal policy as a standard stabilization policy tool. And as soon as the economy recovers and the size of the multiplier falls, then it can start taking care of the public finances, engage with fiscal consolidation. Pretty much what the American economy did with the Obama administration in between 2009 and 2012. The counterfactual of a small open economy outside a currency union, especially a small open economy facing a blockout from capital markets, is entirely different. Usually the recipe there is devalue your currency, bet, if you like, on an export-led growth, restructure your debt, and therefore create the space to consolidate your fiscal balances without taking a huge risk that the economy will fall into recession. Obviously, there are many examples that, this strategy has not been successful. It can be successful if policy institutions, especially fiscal policy institutions, are credible, and therefore agents, households, and firms believe that policy institutions will be able to contain inflation and maintain fiscal balances going forward. But let's now turn to a small, let me say, because I think that's important, Let me say that the counterfactual of a small open economy outside the currency union is not equivalent to the example, the case of a country being part of a currency union, say the European Monetary Union, and then pulling out. Yeah? That's an entirely different story. It's an entirely different story because in the case I was describing, the country still has its own currency. If you are part of a currency union, pulling out means that you have to introduce a new currency. If your fiscal institutions and your monetary policy institutions are not credible, the new currency will be extremely weak. It will devalue significantly with significant massive income losses and losses of wealth. You basically flirt with the how much a liberal democracy can tolerate in that case. Let me use Barry Eichengreen's quote that joining the European Monetary Union is like checking in the Hotel California, where you can check in, but you can never check out. I totally ascribe this statement. So now let me turn to a situation we are actually facing, that is managing a crisis when policy space, not just fiscal space, but policy space overall is constrained. A small open economy in a currency union, there is no fiscal space because you're blocked out from capital markets. There is no monetary policy autonomy because the common policy, monetary policy authority is taking care of the common currency area as a whole and not of a particular area, call it Greece, unless the shock is symmetric, which is not in our case. And obviously there is no exchange rate policy. There is no room to devalue and therefore create space to consolidate. One way to stimulate the economy as you look around for tools is to shape expectations, yeah? And the only way to shape expectations in an environment where your hands are entirely tied is by trying to stabilize the economy and bring confidence back both to households and investors that the worst is behind. And therefore, the medium-term outlook looks good. Now, let me now zoom in the context of the European Monetary Union. Back in 2010 and all the way till 2014, there were good news coming from the European Monetary Union and bad news, if you like. Good news, Europe was prepared to improvise and come up with initially bilateral loans in the form of the Greek loan facility for the first bailout program. And then in the form of the European Financial Stability Facility in the context of the second program. So there was a financing envelope there to rely, given that there was no access to capital markets. Let me also add that the reaction of the European Central Bank, especially post-2011, under the leadership of Mario Draghi, was also in the right tune, especially for other peripheral economies. But on the other hand, bad news is that consolidation was coordinated. There was simultaneous fiscal consolidation among a number of peripheral European economies, magnifying, therefore, the spillover effects and the recessionary impact of fiscal consolidation. While countries with primary fiscal surpluses were reluctant to stimulate despite the fact that they had fiscal space. That's one of the key weaknesses of the EMU architecture. Countries with deficits have to obviously consolidate their fiscal balances, but countries with surpluses are not obliged to take any action. And also, the second piece of bad news is the initial reluctance of Europe to offer a big enough financing envelope that would make adjustment in Greece, fiscal adjustment, more gradual, therefore less painful in terms of output and employment loss. I'll say a few more things on this in a while. So let me turn to the key pillars of the first two bailout programs, economic adjustment programs. I know that you can't, you know, put them together. There are significant differences between them. But for the sake of simplicity, let me assume that the key pillars, the key characteristics, remained unaltered between the first and the second program. And these key pillars were aggressive, front-loaded fiscal adjustment with very ambitious fiscal targets. And we all know that pace, adjustment pace, matters. We all know that when it comes to fiscal consolidation, it makes a big difference how quickly you consolidate. Second pillar, debt relief didn't come till way into the second program, whereas in all other adjustment programs, debt relief comes first. So it should be upfront to shape expectations that debt will be sustainable going forward. Third, the sequencing of reforms was wrong. There was a lot of emphasis on labor market reforms. And actually, if we go back to the graph I was showing you earlier, here it is, and you look now at the second part of the graph, post-2009, you can see that the relative unit labor costs fell dramatically from a peak of 120 to something near 90, 95 maybe, 98, more than 20%. Yeah, a significant drop in relative unit labor costs. So a lot of adjustment in the labor markets. But if you turn to the product markets and you see the behavior of relative prices, export prices, the adjustment was nowhere near as big. Adjustment was less than 10%, was about 8 to 9%. So a lot of emphasis on deregulating labor markets with significant side effects. No emphasis on product markets. Therefore, no gain in terms, or no major gain in terms of competitiveness. So the only tool that could have sustained growth in face of a significant fiscal adjustment didn't really work. And finally, a significant communication failure, a significant failure in communicating the benefits of reforms, a failure to convince parts of society that in each and every reform, there are losers, but there are also winners. And winners may be significantly more than losers. If you like, the welfare for the society as a whole would improve. Finally, this list of the four pillars of the first two programs point to an answer as to why Ireland and Portugal did so much better. They recovered much faster. They left programs with clean exits in time, whereas Greece is still in a bailout program. And the answer is that their fiscal adjustment was nowhere as big and nowhere as aggressive as the Greek fiscal adjustment. The emphasis was squarely on product market reforms, especially on Portugal. Ireland is a different story altogether. And communication was much better. And political consensus was much better than it's been in Greece throughout those 6-7 years. Very quickly, because I'm running out of time, here's a flavor of the size of fiscal consolidation in the first two programs, we are looking at the structural balance as a share of potential output. So when the line goes up, you're basically looking at the actual discretionary fiscal effort of the Greek governments from 2009 all the way to 2013, a major effort of nearly 20% of GDP. Yeah. Let me skip a few graphs and return to the success of the other two programs, the Irish and the Portuguese program, as opposed to the Greek one. Let me also try to answer a very hot, very interesting political issue crops up in political debates in Greece all the time. If there were no elections in January 2015, would Greece have left the bailout program successfully and be on track to recovery? We go back to the original graph I show you. The question can be phrased as follows. If there were no elections in T plus 6, would the red line steep turn upwards at that point or not? I think the answer to the question is in the data. Let's look at the Irish and the Portuguese program conclusion. I will skip the Irish because it's not really a similar case. Let's look at the Portuguese program conclusion. 6 months before conclusion, the Portuguese 10-year bond yield was 6%, prohibitive for market access under normal assumptions. The month of conclusion, May 2014, the 10-year bond yield was 3.5%. So in the last 6 months of the program, the yield landed into a territory that is safe to exit, basically. Same goes for 7-year bond yields. 6 months before conclusion, they were up to 6%. Month of conclusion, May 2014, they were down at 3%. Cash buffer at the end of the program, enough to cover 1 year's external obligations. End of the second Greek economic adjustment program, February, the month after the elections, February 2015, the 10-year bond yield in June 2014 was at 6%, exactly where it was in the Portuguese case, 6 months before the conclusion of the Portuguese program. October 2014, well before the elections, the yield was up at 8%. And the same goes for 5-year bond yields. In December 2014, there was no cash buffer at all. So you can't really exit the program with interest rates up at 8% and no cash buffer. Markets won't take you seriously. They won't lend you. And you can see this very clearly here. Blue line is the Portuguese 10-year bond yield. Red line is the Greek. 6 months before the end of the program, the yields were pretty much at par. And the same goes for 5 months before the end of the program. But whereas the Portuguese yield was falling steadily towards the exit, the Greek one was rising. At the end of the program, the Portuguese was at 3.7, the Greek was at 9.96. So all in all, that's strong evidence that there would definitely be a third program following the unsuccessful conclusion of the second program. And I just described why we think the first two programs were ill-designed. I repeat, front-loaded aggressive fiscal consolidation, emphasis on labor markets and neglecting product market reforms, poor communication, and no debt relief, especially in the first program. These are exactly the four issues, the four lessons, if you like, that we took into account in summer 2015 when we designed, when we negotiated the design of the third bailout program. Obviously, when you negotiate, you don't get exactly what you want because you don't negotiate with yourself. But the third program clearly has significantly lower primary fiscal targets and therefore a significantly milder fiscal path going forward, with targets of minus 0.25 last year, 0.5 this year, 2015, 2016, 175 this year, before we reach the top of 3.5 in 2018. There has been a lot of emphasis on product market reforms, and there is still a lot of work to do in this direction. I'll say a few things in a while. There has been emphasis on repairing the fragility of the banking sector with restoring healthy conditions of governance and creating a market for non-performing loans that was not there before. And clearly, there is plenty of work to do on the communication front. It's one of the areas where I think the record is well below where it should be. So going forward, again, let me conclude with some data. Quarter 2, 2016, quarter 3, 2016, and we expect also quarter 4, 2016, experienced positive growth. There are signs, therefore, that 2016 will close with a positive sign. The economy exited the 2015-2016 recession early and rebounded strongly. However, the key question is how to turn now the current rebound into a sustained recovery. And here is the five things we need to push forward with. First of all, enhance further fiscal credibility. The way to do it is to meet fiscal targets, those targets agreed in August 2015 in the context of the third bailout program, as we have done so far. Create space where we can to promote inclusive growth. One key new tool that we came up with, obviously, it's a tool well known everywhere else but hasn't been applied in Greece before, is a thorough spending review to identify areas where resources are wasted and therefore can be redirected to uses with more social efficiency, if you like, such as the welfare state in health. Mend the fragile credit system. As I just mentioned, recap is not enough. It's not enough to throw money in broken banking institutions. You need to create the right environment with a well-regulated non-performing loans market and good conditions of governance. Promote product market reforms to attract foreign direct investment because savings are low. And because taxes are high, there is no other way. It's a steep policy trade-off, if you like. There is no other way to attract foreign direct investment unless you convince that Greece is open for business. And the key message will come out of promoting product market reforms. And finally, the point I made before, improve communication, explain what you do, explain why reforms are beneficial for society. So I'll stop here. I know I haven't touched upon a long list of current issues, including Article 4. I'm waiting questions on them, but I think I should stop here and give the speech the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. We should have time for plenty of questions and discussion. Perhaps I could start off and follow from what you've been saying. I guess there were a couple of themes that stood out to me. One is that you were clearly suggesting that in the context of Greece, the importance of remaining in the Eurozone was a very high priority. Secondly, you were also suggesting that one of the problems of the crisis has been the sequencing of reforms, and that stands something of a contrast when we think of the beginning of the crisis and the kind of discourse we had from Syriza at the time. What do we think of at the period? We think of Yanis Varoufakis contemplating Greece's exit from the Eurozone. We think of the blame being placed for the crisis on the Troika, indeed the demonization of the Troika for the crisis. But what I've taken from your very clear and very analytical, superb presentation now is that both of those things seem to be wrong. That is, Syriza was wrong to contemplate euro exits. It doesn't work in a small open economy already inside a currency union. And secondly, the blame for the crisis seemed to be the ultimate cause, quote, were the weak fiscal institutions in Greece. We hadn't heard so much of that in the early parts of the government period. That's the cause of the crisis was domestic, and the paramount importance was to remain in the Eurozone.
I think it will come as no surprise to some of you that my views and the views of Yanis Varoufakis were entirely different.
But if we didn't
first half of
I appreciate that, but if we don't personalize it just to Varoufakis, but Syriza 2015, 2016. You were at the eye of the storm whilst Varoufakis and Zakolatos have been negotiating with the creditor institutions. So presumably in private, you must have been saying, you're wrong, we need to stay in the Eurozone, and you're wrong, we need to reform domestically.
I think there is there was and there still is a clear and unequivocal commitment to remain in the Eurozone, because we are part of the Eurozone, we are part of Europe. And I think the Prime Minister has made that clear time and again. Even if you go back to before the elections of January 2015, his commitment, I think, was clear. We can spend a lot of time discussing the first half of 2015. I would prefer to leave this for my memoirs. we can better discuss it, after 2 or 3 years or more. What I can say is that, as for any other new government, there is a learning curve. For many of us, it's been a very steep learning curve. For others, it's been flat. For the government and the Prime Minister himself, I think, it's been steep, and it's been quite clear where the interests of the country lie. I think there was no question at all. Even at the time of calling a referendum, I don't think there was any intention to flirt with an alternative.
So the Prime Minister has been through a steep learning curve, and the negotiations of the time and the calling of the referendum, at no stage did the Prime Minister contemplate exit. And I just want to then appreciate there's an academic interest in talking about the history, and we should be talking now about 2017. Of course, in all of the media at the moment, there is so much focus on conflicts within the IMF and the Eurozone, etc. And much of that discussion seems to refer in part for the need for Greece to do more to justify debt relief. Given the paramount importance of staying in the Eurozone, presumably then your advice is that Greece should do the necessary domestic reform measures that the IMF and the Eurozone are demanding.
No, I think the track record of this government from September 2015 all the way till now on legislating and implementing reform has been impressive. If you compare it with, especially on product markets, if you compare it, there is no action on the labor market still now, but on product markets, I think the record is significantly better than in the previous 5 years. So I think the track record speaks for itself. On fiscal and fiscal structural, again, the data suggests that credibility has been returned and through meeting primary fiscal targets. Last year, we exceeded, actually, the primary fiscal target by 0.5%. Early estimates of 2016 suggest that the primary outcome of 2016 is above 3% of GDP, is above 3% of GDP, whereas the target was 0.5%. So again, a significant overperformance that points towards better collection, better compliance, better credibility in managing public expenditure. And if you finally turn on the financial sector, I think both the recapitalization exercise on November 2015, but importantly, the fundamental issues of correcting bad governance practices and creating a non-performing loans market, key for restoring health in the banking sector, were two key reforms implemented by this government, not the previous ones.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's been very clear and very helpful with your answers. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. Colleagues have microphones. Can I invite you to ask questions? Could you simply say, first of all, who you are and then the question? We are a little tight for time, so please, no speeches, questions, please. Can we take the gentleman here? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Bernard Casey from LSE. With respect to the IMF's view and the view about the size of future primary surpluses, on the one hand, much of the IMF is suggesting that one ought to go a little easier. But on the other hand, the government is pretty vituperative in its view about where the IMF stands. Could you comment upon the IMF versus the German relationship here and who should be involved in what?
Thank you. Could we take the lady at the very back, please?
Hello, my name is Evdoxia Limperi. I'm Greek correspondent for ERT, the Greek public broadcaster. My question, Minister, is how does Greece respond to the disagreement between the IMF and the European institutions on the Greek deal that bring literally the procedure into a stagnation? When do you see, and secondly, when do you see the review to conclude? Thank you.
Thank you. Can we take one more question? The gentleman here, please.
Thank you for your talk. My name is Andy Waters. Thank you for laying out these five solutions and looking ahead. What do you think the biggest impediment is to enacting those solutions?
Should we start with those?
Yeah, sure. So, on the primary surplus targets post-program, which was the first question, we actually agree with the IMF that a milder fiscal path is desirable. It's obvious. We need to create fiscal space, especially while the economy is recovering from the recession we were looking at half an hour ago. So I think what the IMF proposes is entirely sensible, and we are entirely in agreement. Where we disagree with the IMF is on our ability to deliver higher primary surpluses. So we think it's possible to deliver higher primary surpluses, and we have actually done it already, but at the same time we think it's desirable to lower them going forward. Now, when you negotiate, and one of the problems of this negotiation is that there are many parts involved. You don't just negotiate with one, but with four institutions and obviously a large number of member states. You need to understand that a possible compromise, a workable compromise, is away from the first best of each one of the sides. Yeah, you need to be prepared to identify the contours of a second best solution. For the IMF post-program, any primary fiscal target above 1.5% would require additional measures, despite the fact that Greece has already generated primary fiscal targets above 1.5%. That's exactly where we disagree with them. We think there is no need for any additional fiscal measures, especially post program. Now, time is of essence. I referred before to the need to shape the expectations of households and firms and international investors, convince them that the medium-term outlook of the economy is good. And therefore, they should come and invest, consume, buy Greek debt at the end of the day, by the end of the program. And we can't waste time. So we work hard to offer solutions and bridge the gap between Germany on one hand and the IMF on the other. The root of the problem there is the burden-sharing issue. How much debt relief Germany or the euro area as a whole will be willing to concede. And therefore, the flip side, how high primary surpluses we need to generate. I think we all need to move away from, our stance is clear, we need lower primary surpluses going forward, and we need a clear parameterization of the medium-term debt relief measures in line with the Eurogroup agreement of May 25th. Well, that's clear. Nothing more than what we have agreed. But I think all of us will need to move away from corner solutions and quickly try to define the landing space, because having a very good solution in 5 months makes no sense. You need it now. It's better to have a slightly worse solution now than have a better one in 5 months' time.
So what do you think the prospects are for an agreement on February the 20th?
Well, clearly we are in touch with all four institutions on a regular basis, on a daily basis, I would say. And we are working hard to be able to report significant progress by February 20th.
The Financial Times was saying the other day that they believe that Greece has funding until July and doesn't actually need further installments of the bailout funding until after July. Is that correct?
I think that's the wrong way to think of the Greek program. If we leave time pass all the way till May, June, not to mention July, uncertainty will return. Uncertainty is the worst thing can happen to an economy that rebounds from a deep recession. Investment projects, consumption of durable goods will be postponed again. The cost of borrowing for firms through issuing corporate bonds will go up. And my fear is that we won't be having the time to recover the lost ground post-June. So those who think that we should let things drift all the way till June, because the Greeks will be with their back on the wall and sign anything they get, are wrong, mainly because by that time, the Greek economy will be back to a typical uncertainty liquidity cycle, similar to the one we experienced in 2015. And I think the program will be dead on the water. I think people will start talking about an extension, about a fourth program. If we go back to the graph I was showing you, you need to start lowering your borrowing costs a year before you exit the program, gradually. And you have to start testing the markets 9 months before the end of the program. If we let time pass all the way till May, June, we are in serious trouble. And we're fully aware of it, fully aware, and do everything to avoid it.
Okay. And the gentleman here was asking, what was the biggest impediment, do you think?
I mentioned communication. Communication is very important. I never imagined, before I joined the government, I never imagined how important communication is for the success of a policy. I was thinking that all you need to do is to shift your curves up and down, use your levers, and you will basically achieve what you want. But communication, especially in an environment where you're policy constrained, is extremely important because it's your tool to shape expectations. Yeah? So it's an area we really need to work much harder than we have done so far. That's one thing. The other thing is that we have to do everything to avoid the return of uncertainty I was talking about a minute ago. We went through a cycle, thankfully a short cycle of liquidity uncertainty in the first half of 2015. We rebounded quickly, the Greek economy rebounded quickly. It proved to be extremely resilient. We don't want a second phase of uncertainty. We need to do everything to avoid it.
Good. Other questions, please? Could we take the gentleman at the very back?
Thank you. My name is Yannis Andritsopoulos, journalist for Tanea, Greece's daily newspaper. So, Minister, what concessions are you prepared to make to come to an agreement with Greece's lenders? Will you lower pensions and cut tax rates as they ask you to do? Thank you.
Thanks. And then there's someone here. Yes, can we take the lady here, please?
Hello. Thalia Magioglou from the Hellenic Observatory. My question relates to unemployment of Greek youth. We heard Minister Tsakalotos last year referring to 50% of unemployment for youth, according to the OECD. Is there a change a year after? And just a common sense question, why programs for Greece are so ill-designed compared to Portugal, for example? This is just, I don't know if you can answer this, but...
Thank you. And then, gentlemen here, please.
Hi, it's working? Okay. It's Isaac Arpidis. I'm a Greek correspondent for Antenna TV. I was wondering, Minister, why you didn't take part in today's Euro working group? There were political reasons or personal ones? Thank you.
Thank you. That's come about 15 minutes later than I'd expected. the first question, though, was about which measures would you satisfy?
Obviously, you don't expect me to start listing, opening my cards, opening our cards, and explaining exactly what we are actually negotiating. What I can say is that we are looking for a global solution. It's not a matter of giving out something. It's a matter of trying to bring together all elements that need to be in place for the successful conclusion of the review as quickly as possible. And these include the staff level agreement. They also include the fiscal path going forward, post-program, and therefore the medium-term debt relief measures. but they also include ways to bridge the gap between the IMF on one hand and the European institutions on the other on this fiscal path. That was the first question. Let me take the chance and say that the IMF has repeatedly failed to forecast with any definition of accuracy the primary fiscal outcomes of Greece. And that goes back to the previous program, actually. I'll give you the example of 2015. They were forecasting a primary fiscal deficit of minus 0.6. Final outcome was plus 0.2. This year, they were forecasting a primary fiscal deficit of minus 1. Of minus 1. And the final outcome, that's an estimate. We don't. We need to wait for the confirmation, but we believe it will be in the territory of 3 to 3.5%. A huge gap, a huge forecast error. If you go back to the World Economic Outlook, an official IMF publication of September 2015, that's right after the agreement of August, the IMF's forecast for 2018 was a primary surplus of 2.5. For 2019, a primary surplus of 3.5. Now, since September 2015, we legislated additional fiscal parametric measures of nearly 3% of GDP, phased in over the next 3 years. Yet the IMF has revised their primary surplus downwards. We can't see any sense. I don't think many people can see any sense. But we are eager to reach an agreement because we know that time is of essence. Yeah. Turning now to the question on the unemployment of the Greek youth, it's a very good question. I didn't show you. I had the data on unemployment, but finally I didn't flash them up on the projector. So there is a significant cyclical component of unemployment. Nearly 10% of unemployment is out of 23% is cyclical, which is huge. And there is also a core structural component of 13%. Went up from 10% before the crisis, mainly as the result of young people being unemployed for more than a year. And therefore losing skills, being detached from the labor market, and so on. End of 2016, figures are better than they were end of 2015. Aggregate unemployment is lower. Youth unemployment is lower. But rates are significantly higher than any other European country. Yeah? I think the big issue, the big issue we need to campaign for, the narrative of the day after, is how to bring down unemployment, how to bring back people back to work, and especially young people, because it's not only that they are detached from the labor market, it is also that they lose skills, and therefore the productive potential of the economy suffers significantly. It's a long-term damage. So
we wouldn't normally ask the question, but why have you come to the LSE and not Brussels?
Listen, that's not the first time I'm not attending a Euro Working Group meeting. I usually do, but not always. There are several cases where my alternate, who is also institutionally entitled to attend the meetings, has done this for me. So I spoke yesterday with, actually had a ticket for Brussels. We took stock yesterday. We took stock of where we are. I spoke with a chair of the AWG, and we both agreed that in this particular occasion, I may, he may spare me an additional trip to Brussels. I will be there tomorrow morning anyway for a number of meetings.
Yeah? Thank goodness you did come. other questions, please, possibly on this side? I'm ignoring this side. Gentleman here. thank you.
Hi, Abhinav from Reuters. My question is, when the third bailout of Greece occurred, you were negotiating with a group of leaders across Europe who were all, let's say, from establishment parties. We are now at the start of a big election cycle in Europe. Do you think about how this discussion could be completely different next year after the French, German, Dutch, French, and German elections, and possibly Italian, with a lot of, obviously what I'm getting at is a lot of anti-establishment parties are gaining ground in those countries. Thanks.
Thank you. And the, thanks, the right at the very front, please.
Hello. You mentioned about weak
institutions. Just say who you are, please.
Pardon?
Who you are?
Oh, sorry, I'm John. I'm from a company called Volterra Economist, and you was my teacher at university. But you mentioned about weak institutions and about legislating, and there's been a lot of reforms. You can't legislate to strengthen the institutions of Greece in all forms. There are things about the way people work, the way people have always done things. How is the government working to try and strengthen its institutions outside of just legislating?
Thank you. Any final questions before in this round? Let's take the gentleman here.
Tom Onions. I was just going to ask, what measures would you see implemented to tackle youth unemployment this year, 2017?
Thanks. Do you want to start with this?
Right, okay, so let me start with your question. I think you can actually, we have actually introduced a number of key reforms to strengthen the credibility of institutions, in particular fiscal institutions, since September last year. There is an independent watchdog of fiscal policy. It doesn't have the power to set fiscal policy, obviously, but it's there to blow the whistle for the government and the public if public finances go off track. Yeah? Clearly an institution that makes us accountable and therefore makes us more disciplined. We have, so that's one thing. We have introduced, or rather previous governments introduced, and we still commit to a rolling medium-term fiscal strategy that allows to plan ahead and therefore design better your fiscal policy, but also allows you to, I go back to a point I've made several times before, shape public's expectations about how credible fiscal policies are. Yeah. Because agents are forward-looking and therefore they know where you're going and they can assess whether what you actually say is what you do. Having explicit fiscal targets, as we do, and committing to them also enhances credibility. And I think with credibility comes fairness. People feel that their money, their taxes are used as they should, and therefore compliance improves. And this sets in a positive cycle that basically in the medium term allows you to not just access the markets, but also strengthen your institutional capacity. So indeed you can legislate and implement that way. There was a question on elections. I'm risk averse, so I will tell you my own opinion. There are significant downside risks for the Greek program coming out of both the Dutch in the other two elections as well. Sometimes you say, better the devil you know. You can negotiate, you've done it before, you will do it again, rather than facing something entirely new. There is also a significant downside risk coming from the other side of the Atlantic. We've been working closely with the previous administration. Our relationship has been excellent, and they helped enormously, I think, at critical times, the way they could, of course. So one reason more to try and conclude the review as quickly as we can, rather than play the risky game of waiting to see the outcome of the elections and so on. Final question was on policies to combat youth unemployment. Yeah?
Over here.
So let me make a more general statement. Pulling the economy out of a deep recession and turning the rebound to a sustained recovery is important, but we need to be a little bit more ambitious than that. We need to have not just a sustained but also an inclusive economic recovery, where parts of society that were left behind in the past 7 years because they bore the brand of adjustment, middle classes, especially the poor, families with no unemployed, 400,000 of them, need to be, if you like, reconnected with the core of society. Otherwise, the completion of the program will not be successful. It won't be successful if we come out with a society torn apart completely. Yeah. So we do face serious constraints and very steep trade-offs. You need to deliver primary fiscal targets of X, Y, and Z, not too high in the last 2 years, but still positive. And on the other hand, you have to find the resources to design active labor market policies for the young to finance a guaranteed minimum income for all those who don't have a job or wealth and so on. It's a very, very tricky task. We do our best, and so far we've been successful. In this year's budget, we have assigned 700 million euros for the guaranteed minimum income and 300 million euros more for other social programs, especially health and active labor market policies, out of very limited fiscal space. This is 0.6% of GDP. And we're now doing a thorough social spending review across the general government with the aim to identify resources that go wasted and redirect them to these social priorities, including active labor market programs for the youth. How much do we expect to save or redirect? Something between 500 million and 1 billion. Is it huge? It's not. But we do as much as we can out of basically nothing, no space. So it's clearly a top priority, as I said before. It should be the key narrative of the day after.
Thank you. I wonder perhaps we have time just for two quick questions. Here and here, please. First of all, the gentleman here. Oh, thanks. Here. I think it's a very friendly question. Here, please.
Hi, my name is Yanis Kostopoulos. The question I have is, considering that the youth of Greece is leaving, going abroad, so labour is lessening, is it really possible to have a recovery, considering there are only the older being left, who cost to the state more, and they don't really produce? Thank you.
Thank you. Sounds like we're going to finish on a negative note. Go on.
Oh, I think you are a little bit unfair to say that older people don't produce. it depends on your definition of the third age. But
I must have seen young people in Athens. I'm sure I have.
There are a few. Yeah. No. Seriously, I think I agree with you. I think that brain drain is a serious issue. As I said before, it has long-term consequences. Talent, expertise, knowledge goes abroad. Yeah, it's not necessarily bad. If you want my view, it's good to go abroad and stay abroad for a while. It's great. It's a great experience. Yeah, but we need young talent and knowledge back in Greece. Otherwise, potential output will remain low. And therefore, as soon as we recover and reach trend growth, trend growth will be slow. And we will have, again, fiscal problems and so on. So it's important. It has very important, not just social, but also economic implications. But the key is the functioning of the labor market and the ability of the labor market to create jobs and absorb young talent. And that comes with recovery, not just with recovery, but it comes with recovery. Turning to the other question, you mentioned capital controls. I will take issue with the FDI thing. I think you're wrong. FDI is desperately needed. No, listen, I heard you, yeah? It's desperately needed, savings are extremely low, and we all realize it. We all realize it. Among other things I do is to travel abroad from time to time, either coming here or going to the other side of the Atlantic to talk to business and investors about the state of the economy and the medium-term outlook and so on. So it's an important part of the recovery narrative, if you like. I agree with you that investors, be it investors on debt or on the real economy, may be receiving mixed signals from the government. It's the communication issue I was mentioning before. And that needs to be improved, but I think everyone understands how important it is. And if you look at the privatization record of the last year and a half, it's not significant, including real estate, including infrastructure, ports, the railway system now, and so on, regional airports. The other part of your question was very interesting. So let me just bypass the undertext on the capital controls thing. We have a banking sector that is fragile. It's been fragile for many years since the beginning of the crisis. Not just because of the crisis. Yeah. There were serious governance issues. Yeah. And obviously the crisis brought them up in the surface, as it happened in many other countries. Portugal, Italy are two of them. And the question you raise is, how can you talk about recovery without a well-functioning banking sector? So. It is exactly because of this that banks were recapitalized in November 2015. It is exactly because we realize how important it is that we change the law of governance And we also created a market for non-performing loans. Yeah. Also, important, as soon as we convince that fiscal institutions are credible and the risk of a new period of uncertainty is gone, deposits will start returning. They have already returned. They have already returned month after month, and in many cases, directed towards time deposits, not savings accounts. Not savings accounts. A good example is that the ELA, the extraordinary emergency liquidity assistance, is now nearly 40 billion, whereas 42 billion, if I remember, whereas a year ago was 95 plus. Again, a sign that the liquidity situation of the banking sector is much better than it was. There is still room to go, obviously, but we are going in the right direction.
Okay, good, thank you. Before I ask you to join me in thanking George for his presentation, can I just mention in 2 weeks' time, that is after the reading week for LSE students, we have two more very topical events. On Tuesday, the 21st of February, we have a research seminar for the Hellenic Observatory on the topic of religious pluralism and education in Greece. Topical. Effie Fokas and Margarita Markoviti. And then on Wednesday, the 22nd of February, at 6:30 here at the school, we have Yorgos Papakonstantinou, former Greek finance minister, speaking about his book, Game Over, The Inside Story of the Greek Crisis. Let me not pause and simply ask you to join me. And I must say a very sincere thank you to George for his very clear, very strong answers and presentation, very much appreciated. We doubly appreciate the difficulties of your schedule and you making the time to come to London. A very sincere thank you. Please join me in thanking you. Final point, if I may, could I ask you to please remain in your seats whilst the minister leaves the theatre? Thank you.